you're in Napakiak, how are you going to go to Fairbanks or go to Anchorage where that spigot is and get the gas out here?
Lawmakers work to deliver gas to rural Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the science that followed the Good Friday earthquake.
It occurred at a pivotal time in Earth science history. It helped lead to the acceptance of this brand new theory of plate tectonics.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
The Alaska House has passed legislation that would repeal the high school graduation exam. The high school exit exam tests student aptitude in reading, English, and mathematics. House Bill 220, sponsored by Republican Pete Higgins of Fairbanks, terminates the exam as soon as the bill becomes law. It allows former students who earned enough high school credits to graduate to obtain their diploma even though they failed the exam. Higgins says if the bill does become law, it will save the state $2.7 million in administrative costs. The vote was 32-5. The measure now goes to the Senate. With less than 30 days remaining in the legislative session, the Alaska House is considering gas line legislation that would advance a line from the North Slope to an LNG export facility in Nikiski. For rural Alaska, the bill includes funding that could send gas to communities hundreds of miles from the pipeline. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
The problem, according to Bethel Senator Lyman Hoffman, is that even with gas takeoff points, people in small villages far from the line will miss out.
If you're in Napakiak, how are you going to go to Fairbanks or go to Anchorage where that spigot is and get the gas out here? So even though the bill said that it was going to make gas available to Alaskans, basically those communities and residents along the pipeline were the ones that were going to benefit.
Hoffman pushed through the amendment to create what's called the Alaska Affordable Energy Fund.
Setting aside a fund that could be spent on infrastructure to get natural gas to other areas of the state that are not connected to the pipeline, trying to get the gas to the burner tip of Alaskans.
That could provide money to advance projects like shipping propane down the Yukon River to Southwest Alaska communities. As written, 25% of royalties will go to the permanent fund. After that, 10% of the remaining royalties would go to the Affordable Energy Fund. The money would not be limited to gas projects. It could address bulk diesel, plus hydroelectric dams, tidal energy, and more. Depending on gas prices and production, Hoffman estimates a range of $100 million to $200 plus million dollars per year. He says that will make a difference in people's energy bills.
For people in rural areas of Alaska, this is the biggest change they have ever seen since statehood.
The language to create the fund is very simple and fits on half a page. Another part of the bill requires the state to develop a plan within 3 years that identifies how to deliver gas to places not directly on the gas line. The name of the fund was originally the Rural Energy Fund. It was changed to the Affordable Energy Fund to include residents who live very close to the line but don't have direct access. Through LNG export, the state and energy producers are looking to sell much of the gas to Pacific Rim countries. As the gas line legislation advances, Hoffman says it's important to prioritize Alaskans' energy needs.
We are finally going to monetize the gas for Alaska. But it was my view that Alaskans wanted more than that. You know, we've always wanted to monetize the gas, but we did not want to make the same mistake we did with taps.
That mistake, Hoffman says, was making money off oil, but not reaping the energy benefits. The gas line bill is currently being discussed in several House committees. It would be among the most expensive projects in history, costing between $40 and $65 billion. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Aaron Marin is visiting Alaska this week to promote a law that provides age-appropriate sexual abuse education to children in public schools. Aaron's law, named after the 29-year-old from Illinois, has passed in 11 states and is pending in 26 others, including Alaska. A warning to listeners, this story deals frankly with sexual abuse and rape. KYUK's Daisha Eaton reports.
A neighbor began sexually abusing Erin Marin when she was just 6 years old.
I was abused from ages 6 to 8.5, repeatedly abused by the neighbor up the street who was my best friend's uncle that lived in the home. And what started off as fondling turned to rape as a 6.5-year-old. And like I said, didn't know how to speak up and tell. And we moved only to wake up at age 11. To now a family member sexually abusing me, and that continued until I was 13.
Marin finally told a trusted adult after she found out her little sister was also being sexually abused by the same family member. When she was 25, she made it her mission to give kids the voice she never had as a child, campaigning for Aaron's Law. The law requires age-appropriate child sexual abuse training in grades K through 12 in public schools. It passed in Illinois in 2013. She says it's important in every state because of national statistics that show that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys are sexually abused.
In America alone, there are 42 million survivors of childhood sexual abuse. 3 million of those are kids.
But only 1 in 10 tells their story, Marin says. In Alaska, experts say the percentage of children who are sexually abused is likely higher than in other states. Nearly 2,000 children were reportedly sexually abused in Alaska in 2013. State Representative Garen Tarr, who represents the neighborhoods of Airport Heights, Russian Jack, and Mountain View in Anchorage, is sponsoring House Bill 233, the Alaska version of Aaron's Law, to try to change those numbers. A constituent brought the law to Tarr's attention while she was working on issues related to family health and safe communities, and she realized it could help stop the persistent problem of sexual abuse in Alaska.
Our rates put us in the top 5 for child sexual abuse, and it's such a life-changing and devastating problem that I became very motivated to work on this issue and look into opportunities where we could protect children and prevent that next generation of children from experiencing child sexual abuse.
House Bill 233 would empower children to speak up if something inappropriate happens, Tarr says, and train teachers and trusted adults to recognize signs that a child is being abused, as well as help children out of unsafe situations. Tarr says the law could be a game changer because the training would reach more than 90% of Alaska's youth who attend public schools and the adults who spend a lot of time with them.
This is an opportunity to really try and get in on the prevention side of the equation and try to break that cycle and intervene at a time where you can more successfully prevent it from happening again.
House Bill 233 has been referred to the House Education Committee, where Wasilla Representative Lynn Gaddis is chair. She says she believes the bill would be a step toward grappling with a difficult problem that's hurting Alaska's kids.
What we're saying is, first of all, raise your hand and say Alaska's got a problem. Number two, how are we going to fix that problem? Is this going to be part of how we're going to fix that problem?
Marin says she hopes so, and she hopes Alaska will be the next state to commit to Aaron's Law. Marin will be in Anchorage talking about her law on Tuesday and Wednesday, and in Juneau at the end of the week, where she hopes to meet with Governor Sean Parnell and legislators. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency released a proposal today that critics say would expand the reach of the Clean Water Act to cover most creeks and wetlands across the country. The EPA says the rule would not broaden its jurisdiction. It says the rule just clarifies that most seasonal and rain-dependent streams are protected, as are wetlands near streams. The agency's website says it does not cover ditches or groundwater. The EPA plans a 90-day public outreach tour to explain the rule. The EPA's emphasis is on protecting seasonal waterways, which is a big issue in arid western states. But Senator Lisa Murkowski says it would have a large impact on Alaska, too, because the state has abundant wetlands. She says the rule could effectively give the federal government control over most of the state, threatening access and development. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Galena residents prepare for another season of rebuilding.
A lot of it was really just temporary quick fixes because it's just the mucking out and cleaning things up. And by the time we were done with that, shoot, here comes winter.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Just 5 years after statehood, Alaska endured the largest earthquake recorded in North America. The quake devastated communities around the south-central portion of the state, but in the years that followed, it also made Alaska the epicenter of extreme seismic studies. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
When the quake struck on March 27, 1964, earthquake detection was in its infancy, and scientists didn't understand much about the correlation between seismic events and tsunamis. But according to the U.S. Geological Survey's Peter Heusler, a geologist noticed a particular pattern in the disaster's aftermath, which has been the key to understanding how this type of event happens.
As a result of this particular idea, which was brand new at the time and really quite revolutionary, we now understand that these plates are converging and coming together along the southern Alaska margin. And this type of earthquake that occurred in 1964, we now refer to as a megathrust earthquake, is the largest type of earthquake on the planet, and these are particularly devastating.
The energy created when the tectonic plates converged was also found to be the driving force behind certain types of tsunamis, forging a scientific link between earthquakes and tsunamis for the first time. Heusler says this discovery gave scientists the fingerprint of the world's largest earthquakes.
It occurred at a pivotal time in Earth science history. It helped lead to the acceptance of this brand new theory of plate tectonics. It showed the world's largest earthquakes are caused at these convergent margins where plates are coming together. It provided a mechanism for launching transoceanic tsunamis. And in many ways, all of the giant megathrust earthquakes are now understood in the shadow of what was learned from 1964.
Though massive earthquakes are a relatively rare occurrence in Alaska, the 64 quake emphasized the dire need for understanding and tracking seismic events.
In 1964, there were two seismic stations in Alaska.
That's Michael West, the director of the Alaska Earthquake Center.
The closest one to the earthquake was in Fairbanks, and there was one in Sitka.
Today, West says the state has around 400 seismic monitoring stations.
About half of those are clustered on volcanoes in the Aleutians, and the other half are distributed generally around the state.
West says the Earthquake Center's ability to detect and pinpoint earthquakes varies widely depending on where in the state it occurs.
South Central, in sort of a triangle with Fairbanks as the apex, that area has, I think, very robust, very good monitoring. And what that allows us to do, it allows us to detect smaller magnitude earthquakes, and it allows us to locate them with great accuracy.
But that's not the case in more remote sections of the state. West says there's been an interesting sequence of five magnitude 4 or larger earthquakes recently in the same spot in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
They're quite puzzling to us, and we are not able to get a good depth constraint. So we don't know if this is on some very shallow fault or if it's some very deep fault. In fact, we have little understanding of why they're occurring, because there's an area up there the size of Oregon that has no instrumentation.
Even though earthquake and tsunami science has improved by leaps and bounds in the years since the 1964 earthquake forever changed the Alaska landscape, there are still huge gaps to fill and a lot of ground to cover. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The community of Valdez was devastated by the Good Friday earthquake. The giant tsunami that formed right after the shaking began killed 30 people gathered at the harbor and on the dock. The earthquake and tsunami destroyed the town. It took 3 years for locals to relocate from Old Town Valdez to where the new town site is today. KCHU's Tony Gorman spoke with earthquake survivors Dorothy Moore and Tom Gilson about their experiences that day.
I was home on spring break. I mean, we were sitting down to spaghetti dinner that night, and the earthquake started, and we'd had earthquakes before, so, you know, no big deal. You just kind of wait it out. But this one didn't stop, and as I remember, I had been ironing in my bedroom, and the bedroom was at the opposite corner of the house from where we were having dinner. And my dad always said, turn the iron off, it'll fall off of the ironing board and start a fire. And I could just see the iron falling off the ironing board, starting a fire. So I attempted to go through the house. And at one point, it's like, it would be like you walking on something and somebody pulls a rug out from under you and then shoves it back underneath you. And I remember falling onto the couch at one point. Then I figured out that if I really wanted to stand up and move, I could hang on to the wall and move back. And by that time, after I'd gotten the iron turned off and went back out to the living or to the kitchen area, we decided that it was time to go outside. And I can remember looking towards the dock and up. Hearing the whistle of the ship that what had just come in, as if it were leaving the port, and I can remember thinking, this ship's not supposed to leave. It just got here.
I was 13 and a half, and we had been out school that day and just bumming around. We didn't have school. It was a Good Friday, and I don't know why that was significant, that we were just knocking around town, and I ended up being in a back seat of a car with three other kids my age when the earthquake actually struck. The driver of the car had just gotten the car. It was a brand, to him it was brand new. He paid $800 for it. He invited the four of us who were walking around to get in the back seat, and we were driving around town. We were actually planning to head, he was heading down to the city dock because the Chena was in, the Alaska steamship. And we were actually headed down there, and the driver, his name was Ed Irish, he said, well, you know, I promised my mother I'd be home for dinner. And we got right to that where the chain was across the road and right in front of Wells Commercial, the last business on the left and the last road on the left before you go straight down to the dock. We parked there in the middle of the street. There was a guy named Mike McElroy, who was a friend of the driver, Ed Irish. And, of course, we all knew Mike. And we were just chatting with him, or I should say the driver and the passenger up front were talking to Mike. Mike left the passenger side window, and he was headed towards his house, which he lived right next door to the Egan house, I guess heading inside, and we thought that he had slipped back in the car and was pushing down on the back fender, the back hood or the trunk of the car, and man, that the car was just a rocking and shaking. And finally we looked back and Mike wasn't anywhere near the trunk of the car, and the driver says, it's an earthquake. We managed to bail out of the car. For some reason, our minds were to get away from the water, to start heading away from the water. It was just kind of an instinct in ourselves. There was no way we could have gotten all the way down the dock and turned around and come back in that time with the congestion that was down at the dock at the time. And yeah, I wouldn't be here speaking if we had gone straight, and if Ed hadn't promised his mom he'd be home for dinner. So a little thing like that turns out to be a pretty big thing.
That was Valdez residents Dorothy Moore and Tom Gilson talking about the Good Friday earthquake.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation for the 2014 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, May 1st and 2nd at the Dena Center in Anchorage. Learn how Alaska can become a world leader in this fast-growing industry. Early registration ends March 28th. More information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP.
Galena residents are preparing for another season of rebuilding from devastation wrought by last year's breakup flood. There was a major emergency response last summer, but as KYC's Dan Bross reports, much work remains to be done in the Yukon River community.
State and federal responders joined Galena locals last summer to restore power, water, and sewer service and make repairs to public buildings like the health clinic, school, and fire station. But local disaster recovery coordinator John Korda is anticipating several additional projects this summer.
Some road work is still going to take place. Lots of work on our power plant needs to get done. Our pool's still not back up and running. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of things that still need to happen.
Renovation and replacement of flood-damaged homes is the other major focus. Korda says many locals ran out of time last year.
A lot of it was really just temporary quick fixes because there's just the mucking out and cleaning things up. And by the time we were done with that, shoot, here comes winter.
Federal Emergency Management Agency Coordinating Officer Dolph Demont counts 87 homes repaired last summer, but confirms a lot of work remains. He lists 23 families who are displaced from their homes, while others are living in flood-damaged houses.
We have 32 homes requiring repairs or rebuild. Of the 32, 13 are complete rebuilds.
Only one flood-destroyed home has been replaced so far. Demont says free labor will be available to all Galena residents doing flood repairs or construction this summer.
People eligible for FEMA help will be assisted by United Methodist Volunteers in Mission, and Samaritan's Purse is coming in to work directly with those other families who aren't, for one reason or another, aren't qualified for FEMA help.
Demont acknowledges that some work done by volunteers last summer fell short of Alaska standards. He says everybody coming in this summer will be trained, adding that all new homes will be on elevated sites. That's a problem for residents of low-lying Old Town Galena, where FEMA is not funding rebuilding. The agency is providing eligible property owners their money toward construction in Newtown, but Galena's Korda says it's not enough.
Some of those people are kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. They can't rebuild where they're at, but they don't have quite enough funding to rebuild in Newtown either. So we're working on that one.
Last week, an assessment team visited Galena to help residents make building materials lists. A STEP State Emergency Management spokesman Jeremy Zedek says is key to being ready for summer construction.
Getting their building materials to Galena on the first available barges will help out tremendously.
Barges typically don't run until mid-May, and Zedek is anticipating one variable between now and then.
National Weather Service River Forecast Center has given us an average breakup, so we'll just have to see.
The devastation of last year's spring flood has Galena residents apprehensive. Korda says people have their fingers crossed for an easy breakup.
That's our hope. I think a lot of people are still on edge because we know full well that the same thing could happen again. On any given year, it could happen. And I think there's going to be a lot of anxiety with this breakup.
If there is another flood, local, state, and federal authorities will be well prepared. Response agencies have maintained a camp in Galena through the winter, and the community remains a hub for the state's Spring River Watch program. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Funding for the National Association of Records and Administrations, or NARA, building in Anchorage, has been chopped from the National Archives budget as a result of a $10 million budget cut. All federal records will be moved to a Seattle-based facility beginning in September. Local archivists, historians, senators, and residents, though, are rallying behind efforts to keep the archives in Anchorage. APRN's Jolene Almendarez has the story.
NARA focused on many factors when considering where the organization would make the cuts. Jay Basenko, the chief operating officer at NARA, said the Anchorage facility had 246 visitors last year who needed to use the documents that would be moved to Seattle. That means the average visit costs the government almost $2,400.
Anchorage is the fourth smallest, the fifth most expensive in cost per cubic foot, and it realizes the fewest number of researcher visits.
Katie Ringsmith, president of the Anchorage Historical Society, said that despite those numbers, many Alaskans feel the facility should have been an exception to these cuts.
When word first came out that NARA was closing, the response was swift and clear that Alaskans want to keep NARA here. I think what's important about Alaska is that we are a region. We are the far north, which is really important when you think of where we are geographically. We are a link that connects us to the circumpolar north, the Pacific world.
Basanko says, however, that moving the archives will help more Alaskans access the records over a long-term basis because the Seattle location has the staff and resources needed to digitize the records, something Anchorage's facility of two employees can't do because of costs and time associated with the process.
Alaska is a very large geographic entity. It can be a burden for many to make the trip to Anchorage. If you aren't able to make that trip, you basically don't have access to the materials. If I digitize these records, it doesn't matter if somebody's in Ketchikan, Sitka, Juneau, or Anchorage, they can get to them from their home. They don't have to pay to travel to Anchorage.
Some feel that digitization is not practical. Author and historian Charles Woolforth is among the skeptics.
They talk about digitizing it. I simply don't believe that. You know, there's thousands of boxes that never even been indexed. Suddenly they're going to have enough people to go through every single one of those pieces of paper and put it on a scanner and catalog it and do the metadata. That would cost untold millions of dollars. So I don't believe that at all.
Also coming to the defense of keeping Alaska's archives in Anchorage are Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich, who both released statements saying they support seeking other opportunities to keep the archives in state, or at minimum, requesting more time to pinpoint important documents that should be digitized before the move. Woolforth agrees there are other options for keeping the records in town.
You know, maybe they could be transferred to the university or some other entity with some budgetary support or something, but to me, it's pretty basic government to keep the records and keep them where people can get at them.
Mayor Dan Sullivan's representative says NARA is a federal issue, and the mayor plans to leave the discussion of NARA to national representatives. In Anchorage, I'm Jolene Almendarez.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson and Daisha Eaton in Bethel, Tony Gorman in Valdez, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C., and Jolene Almendarez from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.